The Guardian. Hello, welcome back to Science Weekly with me, Camilla Ruse. On the show this week,
we might be able to really say if inflation happened and if it did happen, what sort of inflation it was.
If you can show inflation happened, who should get the Nobel Prize?
That's not for me to say.
Guardian science correspondent Ian Sample meets three of the UK scientists who put together a dramatic map of the oldest light in the universe. And
what do people think about it? You know, do you want extinct species back?
Following on from a unique TEDx conference on the subject of de-extinction, I meet with Professor Kate Jones to discuss the science and politics of bringing back extinct species. Also, Observer science editor Robin McKee will be joining us to discuss this week's science news, including synthetic vaccines and a breakthrough in our understanding of cancer genetics. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian.
Conservationists, really famous conservationists like Stanley Temple, is one of the founders of conservation biology, and Kate Jones from the IUCN, which does the Red List. They're excited about all this. They're also concerned that it might be competitive with the extremely important efforts to protect endangered species that are still alive, that haven't gone extinct yet. And so you want to work on protecting the animals out there.
Author and ecologist Stuart Brand there at the opening of a very special TEDx event dedicated to the cutting-edge science of de-extinction, using synthetic genetics to bring back species that are extinct or on the edge of extinction. Mentioned in that clip is my next guest, Professor Kate Jones. Kate is Joint Chair of Ecology and Biodiversity at the University College London and the Zoological Society of London, and she's here to tell us about the historic conference. Also in the pod with us is Robin McKee, the Observer's science editor. Kate, starting with you, what exactly is a conference on de-extinction?
So this was a TEDx event, which was hosted at National Geographic in Washington. And they got together, the organisers got together, a bunch of geneticists, conservation biologists, ethicists, to discuss the whole concept of bringing species back from extinction, and whether it was possible, and how you could do it, and then really, should we do it? So it was a really fun event, actually. And so I went to talk about whether we should do it or not.
So what's the conclusion? Is it possible? Is that the stage we're at?
So when I first heard about this, I was, I think you could probably safely say I was pretty horrified. And they asked me to be involved, and I was kind of very sceptical. And then we had a kind of private meeting before this TEDx extinction in National Geographic as well. And I just sat there and listened to all these people talking, these geneticists, and I thought it was completely science fiction. I just thought, science fiction, I'm Jeff Goldblum, oh no. Mm. You know, not as cool as Jeff Goldblum, clearly. But and then I realised that they're actually doing it. It was possible, and they're doing it, whether we like it or not. So I guess the question is now, how best to work with these ideas and these concepts to best serve the conservation community. And I think there's been a lot of negative reactions from the conservation community, of which I am one, about this whole prospect. And I think it's possibly a little bit short-sighted, because I think there's lots of opportunities here, especially for the new methods which they're developing. Maybe we could use some of those for currently endangered species are going to go extinct very soon if we didn't do anything about it.
You said horrified. It's a really, really strong word. Mm. What was it about it that shocked you?
Well, you know, I've studied extinction for many years now as a professional scientist, and the level of extinction that we're currently undergoing is absolutely horrifying. And to detract anything from that, to put into a few species that are flagship species, put loads, millions and millions of dollars into, seems a bit horrifying. So I think that was my initial reaction. And I think that dilution of effort is one of the biggest criticisms people have. And they're countering with, well, perhaps it generates a new funding revenue, because a lot of these methods are coming from human genetics. So making human genetic markers or understanding the, you know, the genetic basis of diseases. The methods are coming from there. So maybe we can piggyback onto this. So this is a very controversial topic, which is not black and white, I think.
So I watched the video on the conference, and one of the species they were talking about was the passenger pigeon. Can you tell me a little bit about that? And they were going to bring that one back, am I right?
Yeah, they're trying to recreate the genome from museum specimens, and they are trying to then figure out the kind of markers for things that make a passenger pigeon a passenger pigeon, and then reinsert that back into its closest relative, the rock dove. And then there were some crazy ideas about training these pigeons when they're born into being passenger pigeons. Passenger pigeons flock in millions. So how could you develop those social systems so those social systems aren't very easy to bring back? So I was a little bit sceptical about that one.
Robin, you look like you're bursting to say something.
Yes, I'm certainly bursting. It's a great subject. Lots of things to say about it. In the case of the passenger pigeon, of course, that was... It's an interesting example. There's no point in bringing back a species, reintroducing it, if you have not eradicated the grounds for its original extinction, because it'll just get wiped out again. Now, in the case of the passenger pigeon, the Americans just shot them out, just shot them in their millions. One presumes that if you reintroduce them now, they won't do it. So it's an example of a species where you could see there was some justification. But the interesting thing you're also raising is they have social behaviours. How do you reintroduce a social behaviour to a species that's been wiped out? It's the same as perhaps chimpanzees. Chimpanzees have different cultures. And if you eradicate them in one place, when you put something else back in, the different... from a different place, the culture is actually lost. So how do you, you know, how the cultural aspect of this is obviously crucially important, isn't it?
Yeah, I agree. And I also feel strongly about the threat which originally made them extinct has to be gone. Mm. And also they need to have a habitat which is suitable for them to live in. So the passenger pigeons were feeding on American chestnuts, which are also have been, you know, decimated by... an Asian disease. So, you know, you could make an argument that you can't bring those back unless the American chestnut is also back. You know, in that case, there's also a de-extinction project going on with the American chestnuts. So they're making great strides in using GMO techniques to make them resistant to this pathogen. And I think maybe moving the conversation to more innovative ways of engaging with the synthetic biology community is actually the way forward here. So for chytrid fungus, for amphibians, for example, could we use synthetic biology techniques and engage with the synthetic community, to actually figure out how to make frogs immune to chytrid, or the white nose syndrome in bats in North America? You know, so those kinds of, you know, new innovative ways that conservation can engage with synthetic biology might be the way forward, rather than focusing on a few flagship species. Although I would travel around the world to see a dodo or a mammoth, though, you know.
A mammoth, yeah. Okay, how about a Neanderthal then? I've got to ask.
Oh my goodness.
I hadn't even thought about that.
I mean, there are people doing. I mean, you think you said George Church was there, and he has certainly talked about it in the past.
He has, yeah.
And much to his chagrin, I think, at some points when it was. But it's a real, you could do it. I mean, because if you look at the work at Svante Paabo in Max Planck Institute in Leipzig, he just recently published the full sequence of a Neanderthal.
Yeah.
And that's not just one Neanderthal, but several Neanderthals, I think. We now have almost as good a sequence for the Neanderthals as we have for human beings. So you could actually take the human genome and alter it so that a human being could give birth to a Neanderthal. There might just be the odd ethical question mark over this.
Yeah.
What would be the point of doing that? That's what I don't really understand. Well, some of these species, yeah, they're amazingly cool, for example. if I had to choose a species to bring back, I would bring back the carnivorous kangaroo.
Oh, thylacine.
But for what? I mean, what point would it have?
Because it's cool. It is, though. I mean, I don't think we should kind of minimise that. The shock and awe value and the cool factor is a really powerful thing, I think. And if you can encourage new people into conservation and raise awareness of extinction, that's not to be sniffed at, I think.
But it's also understanding ourselves, because if you clone a Neanderthal, you clone one of the nearest things that's ever been to us, and you can see just how slightly different it is. Why did they go extinct? Why did we not?
Where are you going to put this Neanderthal? Who's going
to be living in your shed?
I would put him on the Observer news desk.
Really? That's going to be a new headline tomorrow.
I don't think so. But there's another example, that the Denisovan man. There's a cave in Siberia where they found what they thought was a piece of bone from a foot of a Neanderthal. The Svante Babo sequenced it, and it's not. It's not a Neanderthal. It's a completely new species of human being. We don't know what that species looked like. We cannot even begin to imagine. Well, we can certainly begin to imagine. The only way at present that we can ever find out what that species looks like is to clone it. Now, I'm not suggesting we do, but that's another reason why you might think about cloning a human being, which is essentially what you would be doing. Obviously, the ethical dilemmas are impossible to overcome, I would say, but it's possible to do it. And when something becomes possible to do, sometimes somebody might do it.
I think that's one of the biggest arguments which swayed me from this initial scepticism, was that they're doing it. Well, not Neanderthals, I hope. But they're doing these techniques. These techniques are being developed for other reasons. And they're going to do it whether we like it or not. And I think the time is here to try to think about how best to use those techniques and engage with people, I think. And, you know, we could think about having a new category on the IUCN Red List, which is candidates for de-extinction, you know, those species which don't have a big social structure, or they're not massive so that they don't take such a long time to grow and develop a huge population size, or some things which are completely evolutionary distinct. There's only one of those in its entire order or family or something like that. So maybe those things, maybe there are ways of doing that that we can think about, or trying to highlight which critically endangered species could use some cloning love.
You know, in my opinion, I would agree with that, with bringing back keystone species that were vital to the environment. For example, is the auroch, is that how you say it?
The big, huge cow bull thing.
Yeah, the big, huge cow thing that used to wander around Europe and make meadows. And it was very important for the ecosystems there, and went extinct. I think it was in the 17th century.
And, you know,
I can understand why they'd want to bring that back, because it had a very important role in its ecosystem, and when it was lost, that role disappeared and it changed the environment that it used to live in.
Let me ask you this question then. Some of the techniques which we're talking about are using GMO techniques to make these organisms from close relatives. So does that make that species an auroch, or is it just a cow with a few genes spliced in it? So how do you fit, like a mammoth, but the way that they're talking about the mammoth at the moment, I don't know whether they're doing it, but they're just thinking about recreating the hair gene and the tusk gene, or whatever genes it is that make it a mammoth. Does that make it a mammoth? If it looks like a mammoth, is it really a mammoth? I don't know.
I don't know. I've not.
Why don't you go the whole hog and make a mammoth? Yeah. I mean, the problem is that we're wiping out species every day, and we're eroding the natural habitat every day. The fight is surely to save what we've got rather than bring back what we've already lost.
Yeah.
On the other hand, I hear what you're saying about what we do is we take these techniques and use them to save the species that are
on the brink.
So species, could we have an example of a species that this would be useful for?
Like the hihi in New Zealand has only got a very few species left. It's a bird. New Zealand.
Okay. You just caught our looks of confusion.
Time for humour.
Oh, so that's, you know, and what some tiny islands have got, you know, very few numbers of individuals. And there's a even an organisation called Alliance for Zero Extinction, which has got maps of all of these, you know, critically endangered populations, like the Jarfan rhino, you know, all of these really few individuals left on the planet. You could start to do some cloning, and not only cloning, but you could look at old museum specimens. This has actually blew my mind. You could look at museum specimens and look at the genetic variation in the museum specimens and recreate that in the clone.
You've blown my mind, I think, to be honest.
So I think this is a very interesting area, and I think I wouldn't be so quick to dismiss it. Which a lot of my colleagues have done. I've got a lot of Twitter traffic on this about why I was there, and, you know, this is a waste of time. But I think you have to look beyond this kind of knee-jerk reaction and think about how best to engage, I think.
Now let's talk about some of the other big science stories this week. Robin, I think you've got a story on synthetic vaccines.
Yes, well, this is the idea of creating synthetic vaccines. There's a wonderful facility in Oxfordshire called the Diamond Light Source, outside Oxford. And basically they whizz electrons round and round and round at great speed. It emits a very specific wavelength of X-ray, very intense X-rays. It's a big high physics facility, but in this case they're using it for biological purposes, and they use the intense X-rays to study viruses, and in particular the foot and mouth virus, and they've allowed them to actually study the protein coat of the of this particular virus. Viruses have protein coats, and they have DNA or RNA inside them, and the protein coat sits somewhere on a cell and inserts the RNA or DNA, and that's then the virus replicates inside the host cell. That's how viruses spread through your bodies when you have a cold, for instance. The thing about the usefulness of this is that you can actually create in great detail the protein coat, but you don't have to have the DNA or the RNA inside it. Now, that's good because most vaccines still to this day have some kind of live property. They're a virus that has been deactivated, and you get the virus into your system, your body sets up its immunity to it, and that should protect you. But on occasions, viruses become deactivated, and there can be problems there. What you want is a nice, stable, synthetic protein coat with no genes inside it. And because they were able to use this facility and give them such knowledge about the structure of the protein coat, they've been able to do this for a foot and mouth vaccine, and they've created a very, very stable foot and mouth vaccine, which is can be used at quite higher temperatures, for instance, than you can do now. And It opens the door to the prospects of a lot more stable vaccines for diseases that we're still struggling against. Polio is less a case where we more or less got rid of polio, but it's that kind of thing that it will be useful for.
So the virus can't replicate at all because it doesn't have any genetic information within it.
No.
Okay.
So
interesting.
I think that could be useful, or really useful, for the agricultural farming industry if they were trying to combat TB, the bovine TB and badger situation. It's kind of driven by the fact that they can't vaccinate the cows because then they can't export them because they've got live vaccine in them. So if they could use a synthetic kind of vaccine, it means that they're completely exportable. You can export the cows and you wouldn't have to kill the badgers. I think it's great.
Yeah.
I think it would be
great. Well, that's a very good point.
Okay, well, some more good news this week is that scientists have released a study into the genetic causes of prostate, breast and ovarian cancer. And this was an enormous study involving over 1,000 scientists. And they found scores of genetic markers that can identify the people who are most likely to develop these diseases. And it's also Well, I found it particularly interesting because it could mean that in a very short timescale, there'd be some kind of way of profiling people for cancer. Who's going to be at greatest risk of prostate, ovarian and breast cancer? We can do a £5 test and we can find that out.
I just think I'm a bit worried about kind of the support that patients would need to get those tests, and having kind of a network of counselling, and how much that would cost, and whether people would really, you know, want to actually know whether you've got ovarian cancer. Or
would you want to know?
I probably would, actually.
You would want to know if you've got it. Would you want? But the question is, do you want to know, are you at risk of it? And the answer is, it depends on the risk. If you're 2% risk of it as opposed to 1%, I don't think I would want to know for prostate cancer, for example. If I was at 98% risk, definitely would want to know. Obviously, there's a grey area in the middle there. So,
And if you can do something about it, you'd want to know.
Yes.
But if you couldn't...
And also being able to do something about it is crucial. There's no point in saying, you know, bugger me, you're at risk, aren't you? Sorry about that.
Really tough, yeah.
You've got to have a drink.
Well, they were saying,
stop snivelling, man.
Well, they were saying that hopefully it would, if people did the profiling and found out they were at high risk, then they could make lifestyle choices that would reduce their risk. So they would stop smoking or they would eat healthier foods.
Well, we're supposed to do that anyway. But it's interesting because it indicates the kind of health service that we are going to have, maybe not in 10 years, but in 20 years' time, where the whole onus is not a health service that treats you because you have got sick and puts things right. We're going to have a health service that is going to try and prevent you getting sick, so that it will pinpoint people at particular risks and then try and steer them away from actually becoming ill. And this is the kind of thing that we're more and more of. We will not be treated for our illness. We will be treated to prevent us becoming ill, as it were.
Are we all going to be living in paranoia in a few years?
Yes.
Yeah, maybe. Or, I mean, I think there's this rise of we're going to become GMOs because we'll all be genetically modified organisms in a way. Because if some of this stuff happens and they figure out how to stop that gene switching on, then could you have a treatment where that gene is switched off and so you don't get that disease?
Wouldn't that be a good thing, though? Wouldn't we all want to be able to reduce the risk of us getting cancer?
But then that raises ethical issues about whether we like genetically modified organisms or not.
Oh, well, I have no problems with that.
Modify me.
Yes.
And then where does it stop? You know, can we become super beings if they find a gene for something that they can, intelligence, for example? You know, this is probably just the start of this kind of investigation, this study, in that there are probably many more markers that they could find. There are probably lots of interactions between the genes for this disease, and there's lots of epigenetics that goes on, so environmental influences on how the gene's expressed. So I think we are something, this is a huge step forward, it's brilliant, but it's just the start, I think, and we do need to understand the mechanisms a little bit more as we go on to be much more successful in treating it, I think.
Thanks to Robin McKee there and Professor Kate Jones. If you want to find out more about Kate's work, just go to zsl.org. And again, we'll have those links on our blog. To read Robin's writing on science, just pick up a copy of the Sunday Observer newspaper or go to guardian.co.uk/science. This week we saw an extraordinary image of the oldest light in the universe. The Planck telescope map of the early universe is a brilliant piece of science. And The Guardian's science correspondent Ian Sample met with three of the Cambridge-based team that put it together to get a detailed insight into the map and into their work.
So we're happy to be joined by Anthony Challoner, Stephen Grattan and Mark Ashdown, all from Cambridge University, all working on the Planck mission. Can I start by asking you, Mark, tell me about the Planck telescope itself. Describe it to me. Where is it? What was it doing?
So Planck is a satellite. It was launched by an Ariane 5 rocket from French Guiana in 2009 with the Herschel telescope. They were both on the same rocket, separated soon after launch and went to Lagrange point on the far side of the Earth from the Sun. So that's roughly 1 million miles away from the Earth, and it's has a solar shield, the solar panel on the bottom. It's sort of to shield it from the sun, and essentially the telescope faces away from the sun and the Earth, and it slowly scans around to make a map of the sky.
It's looking just in the microwave region of space. What is it actually looking for?
So it's observing, in fact, in 9 different wavelengths. So from around 1 centimetre, its longest wavelength, all the way up to 1/3 of a millimetre, its shortest wavelength. It's covering more than a sort of factor of 10 in wavelength. It has the largest frequency, largest wavelength range of any sort of similar experiment. So there have been some predecessors, WMAP and COBE, which have in the sort of 10 years ago and 20 years ago respectively. But Planck is more sophisticated in terms of technology. It's later and it has wider frequency coverage, and its picture it makes of the sky is also higher resolution as well.
Let's get back to basics. What is the radiation that Planck is looking at?
So the thing it's primarily looking for is the cosmic microwave background, which is the remnant of the fireball, the hot Big Bang, essentially. So at some point, the beginning of the universe, it was very dense, and it slowly expanded. And at some point, the universe became transparent to light. Before that, it was a plasma, a sort of electrons and protons and photons all mixed up together. And at some point, it cooled to a point which the electrons and the protons combined to make hydrogen atoms and the light to essentially travel freely from that point till it hits our telescopes today.
And what is interesting about looking at this remnant light from just after the Big Bang, why is that of scientific value?
Well, it's giving us a snapshot of the universe at the furthest point in time that we can see. Obviously, as you look out into the universe, you see further back in time, and the cosmic microwave background is literally the furthest thing you can see. Beyond that, the universe isn't transparent, and so you can't see any further. So it's giving us this snapshot of the universe at around 380,000 years after the Big Bang, when it became transparent to the light.
You have this telescope up there. It's surveying the skies and recording all of this radiation. How do you then turn that into a meaningful map?
Well, it's quite a complicated process. So first of all, the Planck is sort of rotating around on its axis, scanning the sky. We first take the data and convert those into images of the sky. So there are 9 wavelengths we do. So we make 9 maps from those. That is a vastly simplified version of what happens. There's a lot of work that goes into sort of low-level processing of the data. But there, we then take the 9 maps, which we don't only see the CMB in them. We also see our own galaxy. We also see other galaxies as well. And we have to sort of take all these data and combine them together to produce maps like the map that Planck has produced this week with the image of the CMB, and also images of the other things in the universe which our colleagues are also interested in. So they're interested in the properties of dust grains in the Milky Way, for example, or the properties of electron spiraling magnetic fields, synchrotron radiation. So there's also lots of scientific papers coming out on these as well, but the primary goal is the thing that's behind all of these, which is the cosmic microwave background.
Stephen and Anthony, it was down to you and obviously a lot of other scientists to try and interpret this map. I've got one of the pictures here in front of me, and it does look a bit like a sort of a rugby ball shape with lots of red and blue speckles all over it. What am I looking at here? What is this to you, Stephen?
So this is a map of the cosmic microwave background, and the rugby ball shape comes about because we're trying to show on a picture the temperature in all the directions we could look at in the sky. So it's a bit like when you look at an atlas, you're trying to represent the spherical Earth on a flat sheet of paper, and you can't do it very easily. And so this is the scientists' favoured means now of trying to show the temperature fluctuations, so variations, in all the different directions all over the sky. So in all the directions you could look at in the sky on a flat sheet of paper, basically, so we can look at it on our screens and look for interesting features and patterns in it.
So the red spots are where the cosmic microwave background is a little bit hotter. Does that mean that the background, that the waves are a little bit higher frequency or something like that?
So, yeah, there's a bit more energy to the light that's coming from the from the areas marked red in the image. I mean, we're talking about a tiny variation, you know, by like one part in 100,000 going from like the red to the blue. We just subtract out the like the main level of radiation that is this cold radiation at a temperature of just about 2.7 degrees above absolute zero. And then these are tiny fluctuations on top of that smooth background.
Why are you getting differences in the cosmic microwave background? Why should some parts of it be a slightly hotter, slightly cooler than average?
That's a really good question, and it's one that's almost fundamental to our existence. We believe that these are like the earliest signs almost that we can see of structure in the universe. So as time goes on, as gravity pulls things together, those tiny ripples will eventually develop into stars, galaxies, clusters of galaxies that we see today and are of course fundamental for our life. So it's a good job that we do see them. The reason we have them is a very interesting question as well. And this is something that scientists have been, you know, struggling to explain for a long time. And maybe 30 or 40 years ago, people might have just thought, oh, well, these initial fluctuations must have just been in there in the early universe by hand, and we don't know why it was like that or not. But we've tried to come up with theories that explain the pattern of these fluctuations, why there are hot spots and cold spots, and the sort of like the statistical properties of that pattern. And we think that now they come from quantum fluctuations in the very early universe. So small irreducible fluctuations that have been there since like very early times. And then we're now seeing them in that picture. That picture came roughly 400,000 years after these fluctuations were generated.
And now fluctuations in what exactly? What are the quantum fluctuations in?
So they're just in literally everything that the universe is made out of. So we have an overdensities and underdensities of all the dark matter, of all the normal matter, of the radiation, and the fact that all these things move together in itself is interesting as well, because you could imagine things where you had overdensities in some things and underdensities in other things, but that's not what we seem to be seeing. We seem to be seeing that it's all overdense or all underdense together in the early universe.
Anthony, what can this tell you about the universe? What can we learn from this new image?
Okay, so these images actually, they're a goldmine for cosmologists. The image itself has an awful lot of information in it. I mean, if you just count the number of pixels in the map, for example, there's about 50 million pixels. But in terms of the cosmological information, what it's really telling us is, as Steve said, it's telling us about conditions in the early universe, and particularly the conditions that existed in this primordial plasma, this sort of soup of electrons and protons and photons that existed before the universe recombined and hydrogen formed. So basically, by interpreting sort of typical size of these fluctuations that we see, the typical angular extent that they have on the sky, we can learn something both about what the intrinsic fluctuations were like at the time that the microwave background decoupled from matter, but also about things like the geometry of the universe that affect how things actually look in angular scale on the sky today when we look at the microwave background. So by putting all those things together, we can basically try and constrain models for our universe, which we're able to simulate very accurately now on computers. So if you give me a recipe for the universe, tell me what you want it to be made of, then we can predict very accurately what the statistics of this map ought to look like. And then we can confront our data with those predictions and hence try and constrain the parameters of that model.
How well does the data you have match the sort of theories you have for explaining the evolution of the universe from the very early times?
Well, this is the really remarkable thing, actually, about this new release of data from Planck. So the fluctuations in the microwave background were first discovered by the COBE satellite 20 years ago now, 21 years ago. And in the intervening period, a sort of standard cosmological model has emerged. And this is a rather strange universe. It's a universe that's composed, 95% of it is composed of material that we don't understand. There's a mysterious dark energy component which is causing the universe to accelerate at the moment. There's dark matter, which we've known about for a long time that it had to be there, but we've always just inferred its presence from gravitational effects, typically looking how stars move around in galaxies, for example. And then there's about 5% of the matter is just the ordinary stuff that we're made of, atoms. So we can take these model predictions and confront them with our data. So over the sort of 20 years since COBE, that picture has sort of evolved and developed into what we call a concordance cosmology, sometimes called the Lambda-CDM model, where CDM is cold dark matter. What the Planck observations have done is basically increased the angular resolution of these images, so we can see things on smaller scales over the full sky than we've been able to previously. So we are accessing genuinely new information in these images. And it didn't have to be the case that everything held up. The model could have easily broken when we confronted it with this new smaller scale information. But the remarkable thing is really that it hasn't. It holds up incredibly well. We see a beautifully consistent picture. And in fact, the Planck observations, what they really are, is the most stringent test that's ever been made of this cosmological model. And the real headline here should be that it holds up incredibly well.
One of the theories that cosmologists use to explain sort of why the universe is so large and why space-time is sort of flat and that, you know, as it were, is this inflationary model, which doesn't seem to have sort of experimentally verified yet. But what does this data say about inflation? Does it speak to that at all?
It does. So, I mean, as Steve mentioned earlier, what we believe the sort of progenitors of the structure that we see in the microwave background really were, were these quantum fluctuations in the early universe. And what happened during this period of inflation is that the universe went from a very small sort of state over which it could be quite lumpy. It got stretched to enormous scales, making a universe that geometrically looks very, very flat, like Euclidean space, and very smooth. But as a byproduct of that expansion, these small quantum fluctuations that were present get stretched up to enormous cosmological scales. And those, as Steve said, are what we see in the microwave background today. So by measuring the sort of relative amplitude of these fluctuations in the CMB on different angular scales, that tells us something about, in the early universe, how the amplitude of the fluctuations in the matter at the end of inflation depended on scale. And one of the very nice things we've been able to show is that this map is not what we call scale invariant. There is a preferred scale to it. It doesn't look the same when you look at different resolutions. And that actually is a sort of a very natural prediction of inflation. We know that if inflation happened, it certainly had to end because there's a long epoch of the history of the universe that where it wasn't accelerating. We just can't explain observations if that isn't the case. And a natural consequence of inflation ending is that you would expect to have some sort of scale imprinted in these primordial fluctuations. And Planck has made a wonderfully precise measurement of that. We can exclude that at what we call the Six Sigma level now. It's an incredibly statistically significant detection of this this non-scale invariance in the primordial fluctuations.
This also allows you to say something about the acceleration of the universe, the rate of acceleration of the universe, and also the age of the universe ultimately. What does Planck say that changes anything that was known from the previous estimates of those numbers?
Okay, so this is an interesting question because when we look at the microwave background, we're really just seeing the angular projection of something that was laid down an awful long time ago, almost 14 billion years ago.
When you say an angular projection...
Yeah, sorry. So basically, we have these fluctuations in the early universe, and then they get imprinted in the photons of the microwave background, and then they just travel basically along straight lines to reach us today. So an angle on the sky corresponds to a given linear distance at the time that the microwave background was produced. So when I say an angular projection, that's what I mean, just that conversion between angular scales and linear scales at that epoch. So all the information that we really have, or most of the information that we have in these images about the late time universe, really just comes through that angular projection. So really what matters is basically how far away this surface was over which well, so when we look at the micro background, you can think of sort of looking at a two-dimensional surface centered on us, which is an awful long distance away from us, essentially 14 billion years, light years away, which is the surface over which the CMB decoupled from matter.
So like we're living inside the centre of a golf ball or something. That's right. It would be the inside of the surface.
That's right, yeah. It's almost looking like you get the same effect on the sun, for example, the surface of the sun, but we're sort of on the inside rather than the outside here. So in the context of a given cosmological model, so for example, this Landes CDM model that I referred to earlier, that makes rather precise predictions for what these distances, the distance back to the surface, ought to be once you know how much stuff there is in the universe. And by measuring the sort of relative size of these fluctuations on different angular scales, we can figure out what the universe is made of, and then we can translate that into this distance and hence learn something about the age of the universe and how fast it's expanding now. And basically, I mean, one of the surprises here is that we've found that the universe is expanding now a little more slowly than typical astronomers would have thought. And there is an interesting tension between the value that we infer from the microwave background and what you get if you try and make direct measurements of the expansion rate. And we don't really understand the origin of that at this point. I mean, it could be systematic problems in those measurements. I mean, trying to measure the expansion rate directly is a very difficult measurement. So there could be systematic issues in those measurements, or it could be pointing to new physics. It could just be that our cosmological model is actually not quite right.
And it says something else about the age of the universe as well. I think before we tended to think about it as 13.7 billion years ago. Now I think the number is 13.8. Whether this was all within the realms of error beforehand, I don't know.
That's right, and that's all related actually to this thing I was saying about the fact that we now think it's expanding a little more slowly. Basically, the age of the universe is basically 1 divided by the rate at which it's expanding. So the fact it's expanding a little more slowly than we thought means it's actually a little bit older than we thought.
Stephen, can you say anything about these other anomalies which were picked up by previous cosmic microwave background missions? There was an asymmetry that was interesting. There's a cold spot that's interesting. Just take our listeners through those kinds of things.
Yeah, so whereas, you know, by and large, this standard model fits really, really well, there are one or two little features still, maybe blemishes or curiosities that we're drawn to. And there could well be nothing, just instrumental noise that, like, reflects itself slightly in the picture, in the maps we see, or more likely some of these features are actually on the sky and they are real features of the universe, but it's just chance. You know, if we happen to live on a galaxy a long way away, they would see different strange features and they might puzzle about this. And so quite how odd something has to be before you really begin to worry about it is a topic of hot debate within the community. But the features we do seem to see things that have been seen by other experiments. So there does seem to be a patch on the map that does appear a little consistently cold, which is slightly odd. That's the cold spot.
And can we say where that is in the sky?
I could point it to you on the picture, but I don't know its exact coordinates, I'm afraid.
Do we know if it's visible from the northern hemisphere or the southern hemisphere?
It's in the southern hemisphere.
Yes.
Is it? Right, okay. So yeah. Somewhere in the sky that's visible from the southern hemisphere has a cold patch in the microwave region.
A fraction cold in light that you can't see with your eye, so there's no need to go and try and look for
Can
it.
Can you say how large it is?
Well, it takes up a reasonable fraction of the sky, so maybe moon-sized. I don't know if that's a bit, maybe a bit bigger.
But that could be just the way it is, just chance.
It could be just the way it is. And maybe one of the anomalies that could be particularly interesting for us to look at as well is that there seems to be, so rather than just a specific spot, when we look at the statistical distribution of fluctuations in the map, it does seem that on certain scales, on quite large scales, things seem to be a little smoother than we might have expected. So if you filter that map in a particular way and you And you do see that over quite a range of scales, the fluctuations are maybe a little bit gentler than the Lambda CDM model would normally predict. So maybe that's just chance, because after all, these fluctuations are just statistical. Or maybe it's a sign that they're not unusual fluctuations, but the model we're using is slightly incorrect. We can really try and see if we can find better models that fit these features. There's a danger always when you try and find models to fit features that you just make your model up to fit the problem you happen to find. And we'll see about that. I mean, what Planck's done, although these features are just as visible in, say, the previous maps by the WMAP satellite, we have more confidence now in the base model that we use to try and explain this Lambda CDM model. And so it kind of makes the features a bit more apparent, shall we say, whereas you might have had a bit more slack with the previous analyses about precisely what the model predicted. Now you've got a bit less slack, so things that you saw before, you're kind of a bit more drawn to now.
There's this other strange thing where you seem to find differences in the variations of the hot and cold spots in opposite hemispheres of the sky.
Yes, this is odd as well. I mean, if you can, one might imagine there's a theory that somehow has some sort of what's called parity asymmetry.
What that seems to say, if you've got two opposite hemispheres of the sky where the cosmic microwave background fluctuations look different, it suggests that the universe isn't the same in all directions, doesn't it?
So that's what the suggestion might be, and the question is whether or not that is, how much of that is just a fluke, how much of it is real, and whether people can think of sensible models that explain this. It's all very well pointing out an abnormality. I mean, you've also got to say, well, is a theory that explains this abnormality plausible or not? So when you're trying to judge whether or not you really ask whether our universe really does have strange features in it, you have to kind of also ask, well, how plausible, are there any plausible things that describe this? And most of the theories that people put forward to try and describe these things aren't considered widely plausible.
You've got a lot more data to look through. The data you've released so far constitutes, I think, something like 15 and a half months. How much more data have you got left to work through, and what are we likely to learn, or what do you hope to learn once you've gone through that full set? Do you think you may answer some of these questions over these anomalies, or do you think you may understand a little bit more about why the models fit but maybe don't fit in certain realms?
That's right. So we've used 15 months basically of temperature data. So the Planck satellite has also taken another 15 months of data. It's been worked, so that's 30 months of temperature data. And then, as well as that temperature data, we also have 30 months of polarization data that we just basically haven't used in any of our analyses yet.
What do you mean by polarization data?
So light rays, when they come, they don't just have an intensity, they also have a direction associated with them. If you've ever played with polarized sunglasses, if you put a pair of them at right angles, then you'll see no light comes through at all. And so our satellite has an ability to detect the polarization, so like the direction associated with the light that's coming towards us. And that's very interesting, because the detailed patterns polarization pattern can be a very powerful discriminant of different inflationary models. And we hope that with a refined analysis and real hard work on analysing this polarization data, we might be able to really say a lot more confidently about if inflation happened, and if it did happen, what sort of inflation it was.
If you can show inflation happened, who should get the Nobel Prize?
That's not for me to say.
Final question for Mark. What happens to this satellite once it's you've used all your 30 months or so of data?
Well, in fact, there's actually more than that. I mean, there's the HFI, the high-frequency instrument, has exhausted its supply of helium-3 and helium-4, which it used to cool its very sensitive detectors to just a tenth of a degree above absolute zero. So that ran out after 30 months. The low-frequency instrument doesn't rely on sort of expendables, so it can actually carry on running. So it's actually still running now. It will, I think it'll be turned off in August this year. And I think eventually the Planck satellite is in this orbit around a Lagrange point on the far side of the Earth from the Sun.
You mentioned a Lagrange point when we started. You should say just exactly what that is.
It's a stable, or rather a semi-stable point so when they have a planet or orbiting a star or two bodies orbiting around each other, there are certain points where another object can be either stable or semi-stable. In fact, the Lagrange, this L2 point, as it's called, is semi-stable. And what happens is that the Planck has to thrust, fire its thrusters occasionally to keep it in this orbit around the Lagrange point. What happens is it's basically following the Earth around its orbit in the Sun, so it's always facing away from the Earth and the Sun. What happens is that after a certain time, I think they'll fire the thrusters to eject it from the Lagrange point entirely, so it'll fall into an orbit around the Sun. And it'll eventually, because it's further away from the Earth, further away from the Sun than the Earth, it'll eventually lag behind the Earth and essentially end up as a artificial planet.
Will it end up circling the Earth for a?
No, it'll be orbiting the Sun.
Will it ultimately spiral into the Sun?
No, it should be quite stable. It certainly won't happen for a long time. So
your work will be up there forever.
All of the data, of course, is transmitted back to Earth. We never actually get the instruments or the satellite back, so it'll be out there. It will be out there for a very long time. It's
fantastic. Mark, Stephen and Anthony, thank you so much for coming in to explain this to us. It's complicated stuff. Really appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you.
To read all of Ian's writing on the Planck telescope, just go to guardian.co.uk/science. That's all we have time for this edition of Science Weekly. So from me, Camilla Ruse, and Science Weekly producer Jason Phipps, it's goodbye and happy Easter. For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.